Spring fans, welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem. Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast. Today's a very special episode. I'm joined today by both Steven Van Beelen, the lead of the Axon CQRS framework out of the Netherlands, and Ben Wilcox, a senior product marketing manager here at Pivotal. Our discussion is today all around all sorts of different things, not the least of which are Axon, CQRS, command query responsibility segmentation, and so much more, right? And particularly the benefit of using Axon with a Spring application. We see a lot of people moving to microservices these days, and as you start to scale that, as you start to add more microservices to the mix, the question then becomes, how do these things talk to each other? How do we ensure that they see the same state and that they're aware of the other services in their ecosystem? And how do you avoid the sort of reflexive reach for things like distributed transactions and JTA and a distributed systems architecture? CQRS is an elegant way to solve that problem, and it's most, I think, elegantly enabled by frameworks like Axon. Axon has been around for 10 plus years, and I know that because I interviewed its founder and then lead, Axon lead Alard Baize, in 2010 when I was an editor for InfoQ in one of my many adventures. And we talked about Axon then. It was an interesting project for me then because it was a it was built on Spring and it supported Spring and integrated well with Spring. Alard has a long history with the Spring team, so it was only natural that he would extend that when he developed Axon. And it was it's a great piece of technology, and it's just become all the more useful in the era of microservices, all the more valuable in the era of microservices. So valuable, in fact, that he and his team have now spun out a new company called Axonic, which is sort of geared around supporting Axon and the infrastructure required to use Axon. So we talk about all that. It's just for me, this is just a real privilege to be able to join him. I wanted to get this episode out now, as opposed to a month from now or whatever, since I'm not really great at rendering and getting these things out the door immediately after recording. I wanted to get this one out pretty quickly after recording because I am on my way today to Vienna, Austria for some business, but then I'm off to, I suppose it's as much pleasure as anything, but then I'm off to the Netherlands. I'm off to Amsterdam, where I'll be able to meet with the team at Axonic, and then I'll be at the Spring One Tour Amsterdam event. So I hope that if you're in the region, that you join us there. It's going to be a lot of fun, and of course I expect that some people from Axon will probably be there. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So that should be good. I know Ben will be there, for example. So that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to seeing these people just as soon as this episode is out, actually, just a little bit after this episode is out. And you should too. If you're not already on board, if you're not already signed up for these installments, for these Spring One Tour events, they're absolutely worth doing because you get a chance to connect with local people, people who are doing the same thing as you are in the community, as well as engineers from the source, so to speak. So I think that makes it a all the more valuable proposition. All right, well, we've got a really exciting episode ahead of us. I am pretty excited personally for all the interesting stuff that's happening right now. I just put out a new Spring Tips video installment, which for those of you who don't know is a series of screencasts that I do every Wednesday. Well, not every Wednesday. When I do it usually in bursts, and I have 11 episodes per season. And this is sort of a special mid-season interregnum episode that looks at something that is, if I'm honest, very preliminary. I wouldn't go to production with it today, but it's super fascinating that it's possible. It's reactive MySQL support, right? So you will no doubt have heard about R2DBC, and if you haven't, then of course I recommend you take a look at the longer Spring Tips installment that I did last season, several months ago, that looks at that topic in depth. But this is just a sort of addendum to say, oh yeah, there's now MySQL support thanks to a third-party project called JaSync, which I think is really, really inspiring. So that's great. I'm I'm posting this podcast just minutes after having posted that. And the fact that these things are, the fact that I can't keep up with all this good stuff, makes me just super excited to be a part of this community. And I hope you feel the same, friend. All right. With that, I hope you enjoy the interview. Would you gents please introduce yourselves?
Maybe I'll go first, Stephen. So my name is Ben Wilcock. I'm the Principal Product Marketing Manager for Spring. And I work with Josh at Pivotal.
That's a fairly new title for you, though, isn't it?
It is. It is. I used to be a solution architect also for Pivotal, and then for about 10 years before that, as well as an independent contractor in the UK. I live in the UK, and I work pretty closely with some of our partners in Europe, including our friends at Axonic, which is where I met Stephen.
I see. Sonic, what is Sonic? Is that a MQ?
No, Axonic. Sorry, my pronunciation was terrible. Yeah, Axonic, which is the home of the Axon framework, which is a really interesting architectural framework that I know you're familiar with, Josh, but we've been using for quite a while to help us with various event-driven architectures in Java.
You know, I confess something. I have known about Axon for a decade now, but I never realized until just now that the name of the company was pronounced. I thought it was Axon IQ for whatever reason. I didn't know it was Axonic with an AXONIQ, right? That's awesome. That's interesting.
Hey, well, let's find out, because I've been saying it that way for a while, but I've never asked anyone's permission. So maybe Stephen, you could introduce yourself and give us a schooling on whether we're saying it right.
Yes, of course I can. So welcome. Hi, I'm Stephen van Dielen. I am the lead developer on the Axon framework over at Axonic. Indeed, it's Axon IQ spelled together, but we decided to pronounce it as Axonic.
I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's what we went for. And I'm working on the framework most of the time, which means I'm delegating all the questions we get and helping people implement features myself, deciding when we do release stuff, giving the trainings and such. Alongside, I'm also working a lot on Axon Server, one of our other products. But my main focus lies with the framework and helping people using it.
Imagine if Spring Source was actually pronounced Sprint G Source.
Sprint G Source.
You never know until somebody says it aloud. You know?
Yeah. Correct.
So you, Stephen. So you're the lead developer now on Axon, the framework, the project. What happened to Allard?
So Allard is definitely still there. He is our CTO at the moment.
We're talking about Allard Bijze.
Sorry.
Allard Bijze.
Allard Bijze. Yes, it's always hard to pronounce his name in a surname in English. I typically don't do my own either because it's tough, you know, the Dutch surnames. But yes, Allard Bijze. No, he's still around, and I ask him a lot of questions, and I bother him a lot because he still participates a lot, of course. But it's good to have somebody else on the front line as well, so that he can focus on dealing with the business of it all and the other products we're thinking of as well.
Right, so he's the founder of the project.
Correct.
For 10 years ago. And he's the one with whom I've had the most interactions over the years. But now it's a couple of years ago. When did Axonic splinter out into a separate company? That was it's been a couple of years now already.
Yeah, that was the summer of 2017, so not too long ago now.
Wow.
So, it's going pretty okay, I guess.
That was a minute ago, and indeed, the beginning of Axon was just a minute ago, and so to see it go so far so quick
Yes. Yeah, super cool. It's really, yeah, it feels like it's skyrocketing to some extent with all the stuff which is happening and all the downloads we're getting and all the traction we're getting. It's super.
So when you
say that, excites me a lot.
Can you give percentages or absolute numbers or what's a way to quantify that?
A bit prior to the conference we gave last year in September, we hit 1 million downloads, which was, well, it was a milestone. We were very happy with it, and it's an ongoing curve, so good stuff.
Is that per month or per year or?
I believe that was the total.
That's
I should know this by heart, of course, but happening so many things around. So,
For those listening, I suppose we should just take a moment and go back and kind of explain why it's incredible that there are 1 million downloads of this project. Because if I'm honest, something like Axon seemed a bit of a niche use case 10 years ago.
Correct.
But now, in the world of microservices, in the world of distributed systems with inconsistent views of data, it seems like I don't know how we got by without something like Axon before, right? And I don't know how to get by without it in the future either, in this new world where we have, you know, sort of distributed systems. So, can you introduce it? What is it fundamentally? What is the motivation is?
Yes. So Axon framework in that respect, it helps you to set up your system with CQRS and event sourcing in DDD in mind. So CQRS being command query responsibility segregation and DDD being domain-driven design. These are all concepts we hear a lot nowadays, but 10 years ago when Alert started this all, it was indeed quite a niche thing. For some projects, it made sense to actually go that route, but a lot of the times it was a bit overdone to do this. The reason why it's, I think, at least gaining a lot of traction in the world of microservices is that we focus a lot on doing this message-based. So the CQRS is the command and query responsibility segregation. So you have a section for dealing with commands and a section for dealing with queries, which we made into dedicated messages. They're still part of the same systems, though, the command and query side of your application. So you need a way to synchronize that data between those two. And this is where we use events for. So you get these three main messaging components, commands, events, and queries, all having a dedicated routing needs and what happens with them and what is supposed to happen with them, which resonates pretty well with having separate services, either doing an action, a command, answering a query, or digesting events to actually change projections or change or do follow-up operations.
Okay, so let's think. So, okay, let's say I've got. I always find it useful to sort of contextualize that recipe for a solution in terms of the problem. So, suppose I have one microservice that manages customer data. And, you know, when we talk about microservices, we talk about this idea that all microservices should own their own database.
Yes.
And then let's suppose I have another microservice over here that manages orders, right? Mm-hmm. What and each order has line items, right? So, okay, how would I model if I were to stand up a microservice for the customers?
Yes.
I guess that would be, the traditional way to think about that would be a REST API, right?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that could still be true, right? But why wouldn't I just store everything inside of a SQL database? Why wouldn't I just store everything for the orders, the line items in the same database? And then if I'm going to tease them apart, I want to make sure that, for example, line items underneath aggregate orders are updated correctly. And I also want to make sure that when I update customer information, that the related information that needs to be visible inside the orders service is updated. How would I sort of approach that?
So I feel we're leaning towards doing stuff with events here. So letting events being the basis of our data.
Yeah.
So that's why that's the first pillar, actually. So that's the source of our data. And it's not only the source for our models, for our line items and the orders or our customers, but also for the component which makes the decisions in the system, whether a customer can order stuff or not. So the command model in that respect.
So the command model, let's say I have, so I have a REST API. What does the command model look like? Do I send a post or something like that to the customer service? And then what happens?
So you would send a post, an action, saying, I want this to happen. Like, let's say I want to, a customer wants to place an order. So it sends the post place order, which we would make into a command because it's an action. You want to do that. You don't want to state that it has happened. It's just explaining that you want something to happen. That command then goes to another component which can make the decision whether that action is valid at that point in time.
Okay, so when I say send a command, that's command is a fancy word for an object that models an imperative, right? Something that should be done to the system, including it's like calling a function. You're calling the system to run this behavior in response to this command.
Yes, that's a fair comparison, Josh. That's definitely fair.
And so the object itself has parameters that get passed to whatever behavior this is?
So you're falling out a little then?
Oh.
Could you repeat your question?
The command object itself would have parameters that...
Yes. Yes. The command object itself would have the parameters containing the necessary information to make the decision on the command model. So okay. That's typically an identifier to identify what you want to do. So if it's a specific change on a customer you'd be doing, you'd have an identifier to that customer. And then the contents you need to make the change or make a decision.
I see. And so then once you've received the command, you say you're going to route it to, you're going to validate whether it's a valid command at that point in time. What does that mean? You might look at that and say, okay, this customer doesn't exist, for example, or...
That could be a valid thing, yes. That's typically a step prior to this. So we, with the framework, we try to let people focus on their business functionality. So if a command can be routed to a certain point, that's not really the business functionality of your application. That's really the technical aspect where something is failing or something hasn't happened. So what I typically mean with decision making is the business logic of your application, which is deciding whether a certain operation can be done in the domain you're in.
Okay. So once you've decided it can be done, that is, it's an affirmative, it can go forward.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to that command?
So the command is then handled. And what you do typically on a decision-making step, if you made a decision, is you publish an event stating that that has happened. And that's then broadcasted through the system for everybody who is interested in that event.
Aha. So and is this like a Spring application context event or a messaging event or like LinkedIn event?
Yeah, so we mean it as it's an actual event in the Axon perspective. So there's an event bus tied to it and typically an event store. And you publish the event, which is also a Java object with parameters in it, referencing the identifier of the component it came from and the decision it has made. So the parameters which all constitute the change which has been made.
Okay. Now, when you say the events, so you broadcast the event. First of all, you mentioned the event store. What is that?
Yes.
What does that mean?
So the event store in this respect is a mechanism to store the events which have happened in the system. So all the small changes, all the deltas which have occurred in your application are then stored in the event store, which can be a JPA database or a JDBC database. But you can also use something like Axon Server, which we are working on as one of our products, to store those events.
Okay, so we'll come back to that in a second. That sounds very...
Sure.
So... I've got some mechanism. So at some point, I've decided I'm going to publish this event in response to this command.
Mm-hmm.
When I publish it, does it automatically get persisted, or do I need to also persist it and then publish it, or how do I guarantee that both happen, for example?
The simplest thing, I think, is to use the defaults in the framework, then you'd by default get a event store, given that you have something on your class path like JPA or JDBC. We got plenty of other configuration in place. Works pretty well with Spring Boot. We're also doing the works to get it working with CDI. So you typically have a event store out of the box.
I see. Okay, good. So an event store is just and when you say an event store, what is that typically? Is it a stack? I mean, how do you? What kind of database is that? I guess.
Yeah, it's an append-only read store. So you only add new entries, and you read from it in a different format. So you read either the entire stream because you're interested in the entire stream, or you read the stream of a given aggregate because you want to source that specific aggregate from the events.
So when you say you look for records that have a correlation ID of some sort that corresponds to an aggregate now.
Yes, an aggregate identifier.
An aggregate in the CQRS sense has a very specific meaning, right? And by the way, for those of you who may not be all that familiar, we're talking about, you know, Eric Evans's domain-driven design, right? There's a, I think that's probably the best place to look at the beginnings of all this stuff.
Definitely. That's one of the first books I read when I started with this stuff.
And so when we talk about aggregates, we're talking about the same kinds of aggregates about which Eric Evans spoke in his seminal tome. What is an aggregate in this sense?
So from Maximum's perspective, we see the aggregate typically as the command model of your application. So it's the decision-making component. So it resembles something within your domain. So the example you gave, Josh, with customers and orders. So you then have very likely a customer aggregate. So the customer could, for example, move from one location to another. That could be an action which you'd execute to that customer, which would then make the decision whether it can move at that point in time or consolidate whether that's a valid operation to do. Right. And the customer in this respect is aggregating all those info about one customer.
And the orders underneath it, right?
Yes, yes, yes. So in our example, yes.
The orders don't stand alone. They belong, they're dependent on having a parent entity, right? So
yes,
that parent is the customer. So if we had commands, we could have commands that target a particular customer, that's the aggregate ID, but mm-hmm. the data underneath it.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so we've got you've got an aggregate. Now, normally when I think of an aggregate, I think of something that's, you know, JPA, like you mentioned, or maybe some other ORM framework, but basically that's usually the thing that talks to my data persistence gear. How does Axon, can it work with that? Can it work with that layer?
What do you mean exactly here? That you actually store it as a JPA entity or something?
Sure, yeah.
Yes, yes, that's also an option, yes. So there are two decisions you can make in how you'd store your aggregates at this point in time. That's either an event-sourced aggregate or a JPA, as in a JPA entity. That would also work.
I see. So I can store the actual entity in my ORM, my JPA, for example.
Yes.
Or I can store it as the constellation of events that, when replayed, result in the same state.
Correct.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. Why would I store it like that as a series of discrete, but aggregated events, as opposed to just the final result?
So
materialized state.
Yes. There are a couple of things, I think, in this respect. So one of the nice things, the easier upfront things, is that if your aggregate is also a living component, you're making your application, you're changing it, and you figure out, oh, I need this field as well, or I need this field. If you just have the entity stored as is, then you need to do a database update to all your aggregates changing that field, which you actually very likely don't know what it was, because the actual state change which might have constituted to that field, you don't store that. You don't have that.
Right.
So that's one of the benefits of events, I think, is that the events store all the changes which has happened in the system. It might be a lot, but you can always recreate the state. You can deduce that, okay, I need additional information in my aggregate to make new decisions. These state changes have already happened. So now I can start listening to those events which have already happened in my new version of my code, and I can still get to the same format I hope to go to.
Okay, so if I have a system over here that's keeping an Elasticsearch cluster up to date, for example.
Yes.
I don't want to look at the... I might need to look at all the state transitions through which an entity has gone in order to keep my index, you know, updated at every step of the way. Whereas if you just gave me the final materialized view of that object, I wouldn't necessarily have what I would need. Is that kind of the idea?
Yes. Yes, correct.
And the reason I don't have what I need is because I might only want certain events. So I if you gave me the whole thing, I would have to figure out how to my thing over here on the side would have to figure out how to pick apart your materialized sort of object as opposed to the state, the events that were that occurred to arrive at the state in which that object is now.
Yes, yes, the fine grainedness of these events makes it so that you can relatively easy do that.
Yeah. What do you think there, Ben?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the classic use case for this is often cited as audit log. So if you know if you're working in a regulated environment, for example, a bank or something, where you need to keep records of who did what and when and to what and all the information that goes along with that, then event sourcing really comes into its own there. When compared to a mechanism like CRUD, so your classic JPA entity style mechanism, it doesn't keep that information as it's lost every time that an update is performed. So for many people, that's one of the sort of key differentiators between event sourcing and CRUD.
Right. Yeah, the audit history, the ability to see the sort of breadcrumbs that got you to a final place, a final state,
and exactly. That's yeah.
I can imagine that would be useful just because, you know, if you have something that's arrived at a final state, but there was a flaw in the calculations that got you there, you know, 2 months ago. Well, I want to be able to just like with a Git history, right? I can go through and cherry pick the events that I want and ignore the ones that are faulty. Or, you know, replay them, but apply a different algorithm so that it's correct, right? It's just a better way of getting consistency.
Well, yeah, there is that as well. So another often cited example is reporting, you know, business reporting, where you don't necessarily know all the questions that you want to answer in advance. So, and you look at things like business intelligence, for example. One of the reasons that's often been difficult is because you needed to know all the questions you were going to ask in advance of having the data to support them. Whereas with event sourcing, you're able to say, okay, well, I've been storing these events for years, but I want to look at these events in a different way. So I want to run analytics on these events and give me a report about, you know, correlations or cohorts or groups that previously we hadn't thought of as being related. Maybe they are related, and maybe this data can help us prove that.
Aha, interesting. Oh, that's a good point too. Which is, yeah, the fact that you can take out the data in terms of the events, in terms of the constellation of events that led you to the state. That means that if you designed a system thinking the only kind of reporting you were going to need to do could be solved with a SQL database, and then tomorrow you realize that you might be better off with a graph database, you can now, you know. You can introduce that data into this new database as well, right? You can actually replay the events to dump it in into a more meaningful graph than you would if you just looked at the final results.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. Replay is another very powerful, you know, feature of this particular style of architecture. And I know that Stephen also feels quite passionately as well about the ability for frameworks like this, because of their event-driven nature and the way that they're essentially hooked together purely using events, it makes them very flexible. You can change the architecture underneath a particular solution using events and spreading those events out in different ways and sending them to different places to get processed. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit, Stephen.
Yes, well, I think you put it quite nicely, to be honest. You were adding a couple of extra pros to the whole situation of having events being the source of your truth for many respects in your application. It's the flexibility, which is amazing. And the way that you can, if you start developing your application like this with the messaging in place, then you're typically pretty... Your components are loosely coupled more because you're only having those events, which is your API anyhow, because it's the language you speak. It's the messages you receive and you send out. So that's already a thing you share with the outside world of your application sphere. So if you're one-sided, you could start off with a monolith like this. Just have your commands and events and your queries and all that. Focus on those messages. And at a certain point, you find out that, okay, this application is where we're hitting billions and billions of users. We need to scale up. We need to have more. We need this specific component in there, which is dealing with lots and lots of queries to be scaled up to several. Then we can just pull that bit out of our big monolith application and put it in a different one, because the messages are still there, the routing is still working, it's the right code which is still functional, it's the infrastructure underneath focused on this messaging paradigm, which makes it so easy to start with things like microservices.
And so when you say so that's a good point, is there a way to broadcast these messages across multiple nodes, multiple hosts, or are they just all reading from the same event store?
So for that, we have several things in the framework, but that's also one of the major pillars why we actually started Exonic, because we saw that as soon as you're just doing this in one application, it's relatively simple, but distributing your messages, your commands, and your events, and your queries, that's when you land back into configuration and infrastructure stuff, and that's exactly what we try to avoid for people. We want to have them focus on the business functionality there rather than focusing on how do I need to configure this and how do I need to route this to that. So there are a couple of things in place in the framework. For example, the distributed command bus where you can use a Spring Cloud and JGroups version. And we have an AKP solution to send events over, a beta version of Kafka as well. But our main focus in this respect as Exonic is to give Axon Server to our users, which is a dedicated routing solution for all three types of messages. And it's also a way to store your events outside of a relational database model.
Nice. And so Axon Server, this is a new thing. I haven't had the privilege of using that before. So that's a standalone database type thing to which Axon frameworks can talk?
Yeah, you should see it as an infrastructure component, I think. So it's not only the database, it's not only storing the events for you, but it's also delegating messages from one node to another. So if you start up, you have an Axon framework application. You're using the framework in there to have your messages and your command handlers and your query handlers to deal with your aggregates and your view models and such. And you start it up, and it first thing it does, it connects to an Axon server, and that's the moment that it knows, okay, my command bus is Axon server, and my event bus and event store is Axon server, and my query bus is Axon server. So it will send all those messages just to the Axon server node, and Axon server will know where to route the message to.
Oh, wow. So instead of me managing a SQL database and a Kafka queue and all this other stuff, I just have this one turnkey thing.
Yes.
And suddenly my microservice, I can now take an Axon application that was written inside the JVM with one single JVM, tell it to talk to this Axon server. Now it's distributed almost? Sort
yes.
Of, maybe?
Yeah. It becomes super easy. It's less configuration. It's just having that Axon server node there and then... And you can do the routing.
I see. That's super cool. Well, that's great. Okay, so I got to try that out. Now, if I'm in an enterprise, what kind of features you know, I would think there's got to be a security story, for example. Is that?
Yeah, so we got a couple of formats in place for this. The base is free to use for everybody. We are going to make it open source as well, so that people can see it. It's very likely not the same format as Axon Framework, so not open to pull request, I assume, but just so that people can actually see how it works.
Right.
From an enterprise perspective, that's when you get things like actually clustering Axon server instances together so that you can have reliability on your events, so that there's a consensus algorithm in place to get the events to every node so that stuff like that is replicated. So in a case of failover as well, that one of those Axon server instances is still up. There's also a security package in there, so to decrypt and encrypt all your events and other messages if you'd want. Nice. And we're working on a global scale version that you can select your Axon server instance on several locations in the world.
Wow. So. Okay. Oh, wow. That's so cool. Can you discuss pricing, or is that a thing we should just...
Pricing is typically a thing we refer to having contact with us.
Okay, that's fine. Oh, that sounds super cool. And so that runs, I imagine, pretty well in the cloud infrastructures, the prevailing cloud infrastructures. Like, can I run it in Cloud Foundry or Kubernetes or things like that?
So we have a couple of clients doing it in Kubernetes, and we are going through the efforts of getting it good, working on Cloud Foundry as well.
Cool. Oh, that's super cool. This is all, like, I try and keep apprised of everything that's going on, but I haven't had a chance to play with that yet, so, you know, Christmas has come early for me.
That's great.
Wow, okay, let's think about this. So we've got Axon Server, we've talked about the CQRS, we've talked about event sourcing as a sort of widely useful thing. Now, and we've already established you don't need event sourcing with CQRS, but... It can help, right? I think these things kind of work better together. Are there other practices that you find that when taken together make the process bigger than the whole?
That's a tough question. The first thing which brings up to mind, and I already said it a minute ago or several minutes ago, I think it's really the focus on messaging so that everything works with a command or an event or a query, because that's really this message focus, and knowing that a message has a dedicated it has a specific use case. So a command is really routed to a single place, so a single unit, because there's a single one which can make the decision whether it's okay or not. An event is, that's history, right? And everybody should be allowed to read history, so that's for everybody.
Right.
And a query is really specific for a specific place or several places which can answer that query. There are several different routing motives to that all. And this focus on the messaging gives you the location transparency possibility so that you can pull apart your big application into several smaller microservices.
I see. Okay. So that all those practices, when taken together, I think make this whole... Make the whole the pattern CQRS more interesting, I think.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you just mentioned queries. What is a query? We haven't actually gotten to that yet.
Yes. So a query is a request for data. Super simple.
So is that just is that another REST endpoint? Could that be? Or is that another gRPC endpoint? What does that look like?
So that can be several things of that. Internally in the framework, it means that you have a component which is called the query bus, where you put an actual Java object on. Your query, so you have a class named like find order lines, and then the find order lines class contains the customer ID and potentially other information you need to actually execute that query. Then there is you could have a REST facade in front of that, so to answer the queries to your UI, but that UI component can then send the query onto the query bus to another component which can actually handle that query and answer the result to you.
So when you say answer, what does it actually do? Like, what does it have to, what is that result look like? What is it does it talk to MongoDB? Is there like a, does it run a SQL query? Does it actually just do scatter gather across microservices?
That's all what you decide it does. So the queries go to the query model in your application. And since we have events, we can decide whatever form of query model we need. So if we need a relational database to quickly, we want that format for our query models, then that's the way to go. But maybe we want a text-based search system like Elasticsearch, so that we send the query to a component which is actually going to an Elasticsearch instance. The query message in this respect is really to decouple the part where you want the information to who's actually going to answer that.
I see. Okay, so why would you do it? So you're saying I shouldn't just read data directly from the event store.
Yes, you could. It's not per se bad. The query messages is a relatively new thing for the framework as well. But we just saw that this was a missing component in the framework at all, because we had a dedicated command bus and a dedicated event bus. And we were talking about query models and having queries as requests for data, but we didn't really model it as a specific thing like the bus, or actually having a dedicated query message format to contain that in.
Right. So the query before used to just be, you talk to whatever representation of the state that you've built up from the events, right? So if I've got a view over here that's, I got a thing over here on the side that's listening to events, and as events fly by, it takes that event and it makes a change to, let's say, the Elasticsearch index or to the MongoDB database or to the Neo4j graph or whatever. And then the query model would have been, informally, it would have been read from Neo4j, read from Elasticsearch, read from whatever.
Correct.
In a way that's optimized for reads. It's a fast way to read the data from the system, whereas the event store might not be a very quick way. You know, I might want to do key value. I might want to do fast constant time indexed read, for example.
Yes.
The event store is not going to give me that, right?
Yes, correct.
But if I had somehow denormalized the data into to normalize the data for into Redis or something, I could do that. Right? Or CAC.
No, that's the correct exposition you're placing here, Josh. Yes.
Okay, so the benefit here is I've got one way of writing the data and one way of reading the data, and they're not necessarily the same thing. And because they're not the same thing, you have to have consistency, right? You have to think about this now. Whereas before, if they were the same thing, then writing it was effectively the same as reading it, right? You know, with SQL database, I can atomically write something and then get the same state. What does this mean for my consistency now? What if I have an event over here that is updating the state of the order? It's updating I've got a command over here that's generating a new line item that's updating the price for the order or something like that. What does that mean from the view side, from the read side, if I want to get a consistent view of the new price, for example?
Well, yes, you have to deal with eventual consistency in this scenario, because you're decoupled in this scenario. So there's a notion of this where you have to deal with. So from the querying perspective, we have solved this, I think, relatively nicely. We have three formats of actually doing a query. One is a direct query. So there is a single source you want the answer from, and you don't care which, you just want a single response. There is also a scatter-gather thing. So right. That scatters the query to several components which are able to answer that query, and then you aggregate those results you get on the receiving side to pick the one you want. A nice example of this would be, let's say we are an online store, and prices on the web page are always queried. Now, there's a sale coming up. So we introduce a new component which can also answer the query what the price is of a certain product. Then on the querying side, so the component which is actually asking for the prices, it will get several results. And it knows that it needs to pick the lowest result because it's on sale. And that's what it does. Now, to come back to the eventual consistency issue in here, it's typically the view models of a web page you want to be quite, it can be in several locations, but that's what we typically see. What you can also do is that you subscribe on results of a view model. So that's a different type of query we named a subscription query. So that is paired in two things. It's giving you the initial result. So at the moment you query for that information, you get the state of that model at that point in time, and then you subscribe to subsequent updates to that view model.
Like a continuous query in a data grid or something?
Yes, that's fair comparison. And that means you'll get the result as soon as it's actually there. So there's still a notion of eventual consistency because it's not snap, but you get it as soon as it's there.
Right. So is that how is that implemented behind the scenes? I'm not sure. I know about MongoDB has tailable queries, Apache Geode and Oracle Coherence have continuous queries. They have this idea that I can put data into the RAM cloud or into the data store, and then when data matches the predicate that's been asserted against it, it's emitted as an event back to the consumer. What happens here?
So we have a regular query, initial query, like I said, that's going to a query handler in Axon, so an actual method you'd annotate with at query handler. Right. It will answer the first query. Then there is also a thing we call the query update emitter. And the query update emitter takes several parameters, being the actual update of the message, and a filter. So based on that initial query, it can filter, okay, is this query a thing I want to respond to, and the type you're sending back.
Yeah.
Now, under the hood, this works with Monos and Flux with Project Reactor.
Oh, that's so cool. So yes. It's reactive. Oh.
Yes. So that was the key I wanted to leave.
You mentioned scatter gather earlier, and I was like, oh, that sounds like one possible use for a reactive, and I was wondering about this stream of data. That's another great use for reactive. So that's that is cool. Okay, so now you've just described a lot of moving parts. I think it's fair to say. I think there's a lot of moving. If your world is CRUD styled, REST API in a database, then this is going to seem more complex. There's more moving parts, but I don't think any piece could be said to be unnecessary. That's the difference between, good complexity versus bad complexity, right? This is a complex thing to do.
Yes.
But it's not that complex, is it? I mean, I think making developers today in 2019 and onward, making them confront the reality that things are distributed, that there is eventual consistency, that there is no such thing as, atomicity in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And having a toolkit that models that sort of the fact that there are different disparate agents in time working in different nodes, cooperating, albeit at different cadences with each other. I think having a toolkit that expresses those top-level concepts, surfaces them as part of the framework, is valuable. That said, what's it like for the day-to-day developer? I would hope that something that is, in order to work with something like this, in order to be able to be productive with this, it is my estimation that everything else needs to be as simple as possible, right? So I don't want to spend half an hour or an hour writing XML config files or writing tons and tons of Java Bean configurations. What's it like for the Spring developer on the street? Is there an auto configuration that makes all this easy to get started with? Or
yes, there is. There definitely is. I actually even saw that there is an alter tag with your name on it somewhere in the auto configuration of Axon. Thanks for that. It's really, I recall that Aller was dealing with that stuff and talking to you about it. It was so excited. He found it so awesome that it's now that's in there. It's super simple. It's just a dependency you add, and you have the auto configuration in place, and every bean is wired automatically for you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so are there starter dependencies that developers can
hold
in their palms and so on? Okay.
Yes. There is.
So the experience is really, it's a stream. You can start a Spring Boot app, add in the right Axon dependencies, and then just start configuring only the bare minimum essentials for, for example, where the Axon server might live. Is that a thing you might configure?
Yes.
Okay. That's amazing.
So building such an application is actually a thing which Ben and I did on stage a couple of months ago.
At your conference, are you going to have another edition? What is that conference called?
So last year we were at DevOx Antwerp, and we're going to go to Amsterdam to do the same thing this year.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun as well. It's it's very tight on time. We normally use all the time that we have available. But watching Stephen work is really impressive, and it's a lot of fun to do that as well. So we like going out there and showing people how easy it can be to get started with CQRS and event sourcing with Axon, and also with PCF. We use PCF in that demo as a way of putting it into production in the same breath, really. So usually within the space of an hour, we start with a blank piece of paper and end with a fully running microservice CQRS event source application on PCF.
I love that. And PCF, of course, can run things like RabbitMQ, which is the AMQP protocol about which you were speaking earlier. It can run things like your SQL database. So it's trivial to get all the supporting infrastructure up and running and then deploy the Spring Boot apps, just stock standard Java Spring Boot apps.
It is, but what's also true is that in one of these demonstrations we can do a certain amount, and we can certainly introduce people to the bootstrapping and the basic understanding that they need to start to maybe start themselves on that learning curve, on that journey of picking up the skills and expertise that they want in CQRS and event sourcing. But for anyone who wants to go further, something that Stephen and Allard and myself and a whole group of people, talented people at Pivotal and Solstice worked on was a reference architecture for CQRS called the Axon Trader. So you can find that out at axontrader.cfapps.io, I think. And yep. There is a, that's not only a running example where you can go and use your browser and pretend to log in as a user and see the application in action, but also all the source code involved with that, all the background source code is available too. You can see how it's deployed onto PCF. And you can even see some of these more complicated concepts, like the subscription queries, for example. You can see an example of that working in that particular application.
Oh, that's so cool! I'm clicking around on the website right now, and it's fast, and it's got a nice, snazzy user interface. So, if anybody had any, I think it's ridiculous, but I think it's fair to say that as interesting technically as something might be to a developer, at some point in the hierarchy, pretty pixels matter. And so having a demo that drives that all home in a easy to digest sort of fashion is very useful.
Yeah, it is. And you're right. I mean, it looks lovely, and that's largely down to the work of our colleagues at Solstice, who helped us with bringing the user interface right up to date. But also in the background is quite modern. It's deployed as several microservices. It's polyglot. There's some Node JS parts, there's some front end stuff with Angular, there's some other back end is Java and Axon framework. We're using some of the services as well for PCF. So like you said, we've got MySQL in there and some RabbitMQ as well doing our messaging. It's a good meaty example. It's quite comprehensive. It does show an awful lot of the framework, I think.
Love it. Now, you just mentioned Node.js, which is, as I understand it, one of those other non-Java Spring technologies that I've heard about but don't ever wish to try. And you earlier mentioned something called CDI. Tell me a little bit about that. Hopefully people that are using Axon from within CDI can get the full benefit of the framework. How far along is that? That sounds very interesting for people that are using that, even though it's not Spring. It fills me a little bit inside.
Yes, I understand that. No, it's we see that there is definitely some requests on the CDI configuration side of things. There were a couple of non-solicited projects doing that. So we weren't really looking at that. We took the effort somewhere mid last year, I think, to talk to those people to ask whether we could upgrade that to an actual extension that we are controlling and we are surveying. So that's what we're doing. It's going pretty well. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure if everything's in yet. But we have users which are using it because they were using it prior to that as well, whilst it wasn't completely finished too. So,
Very cool. So that I think that speaks volumes to the appetite of users to get something like this in that space, right? They're willing to make do with less than the whole enchilada because it is still so redemptively great and so much better than the alternative, which is trying to hack this yourself, you know? What are some, without giving too much away, because I can imagine that your particular industry and your particular the industries of your customers, those being customers that have large multi-node complex domain model kind of applications, I can imagine that those are the very same kinds of customers that don't appreciate being named. But so without naming so much as the customer itself, can you tell me a little bit about some interesting use cases for Axon, interesting technologies, etc. Interesting, without identifying them, if you don't want to.
Yes.
How are people? Why are they using it?
Why are they using it? A lot of people come back to the audit log thing at first, seeing event sourcing and having the events as the basis of everything. A lot of financial companies, for example, need to show what's happening. So also lending platforms, for example, you need to give all the specifics, why a specific loan could be given out or not. And all those separate events, those constitute the actual situation of what the loan is at that point. So we see that. We see it also in several marketing situations for car companies, but the majority comes from fintech at the moment.
And it makes it sound super secret, which is true that, you know, it's like Pivotal, Axonic have a lot of commercial customers, but they are named on the website, aren't they, Stephen? So for example,
right.
There's a list of people who currently use Axonic, and that's on their website, and that includes people brands that many people will recognize, you know, Barclays, Societe Generale, ING, FedEx, amongst others. So, you know, and I think you also have some documentation on that as well, don't you, Stephen? So you guys, you know, we quite often find ourselves in similar conversations with similar people because as Axonic's customers tend to also be Pivotal customers because, yeah, you know, Spring Boot runs great on PCF and Axon is built really great on top of Spring Boot. So we have a lot of overlap there.
Yeah, that's true. No, I didn't want to be too pushy with any names, but you are completely right, Ben. I could be more candid in that respect.
Well, we don't want to make it sound like it's, you know, some sort of super secret framework.
That's true.
That, you know, I could tell you about it, but then I'll have to kill you. that's also you know, not true. It is popular and it's used in a lot of places, and I think one of the reasons that it is popular is because of the huge possibilities that it has with scale, and obviously some of the recent additions, things like Webflux, are only improving that as well. Yeah, I think you guys should be very proud of your customer base because they are very good customers.
Thank you.
When you speak to that popularity, that's a key point. I mentioned earlier, I used to be an editor for InfoQ, and so in 2009 or maybe it was 2010, I first interviewed Allard for an article on InfoQ.com. About Axon, right? And so it's been around, and it's been in use by large customers, by large users, for, you know, better part of a decade, right? I mean, and these use cases have been borne out. So while we're doing this podcast in early 2019, I think it bears repeating that this is not a new thing. It has been in the trenches
battle-tested, bulletproof code for a long time, and it gets better and better, you know? So popular, in fact, that you've now spun out a company, as we established earlier, to support the customer use cases, right? To support the community that has now sprung up around it more full-throatedly, you know? That's really interesting to me.
Yeah, and speaking to that, Josh, you know, as you know, just last year we also made Allard a champion, didn't we? A pivotal community champion for his work on the Axon framework.
Absolutely.
So yeah,
I think it's just been interesting to watch this project get better, sort of contemporaneous with Spring. When I first learned about Axon, it was because I was a committer and contributor to Spring integration, which integrated well with Axon, the very first version. And that was before Spring Boot, before Spring Cloud, and before Reactive, all of which now figure prominently in the current versions of Axon, which were just ideas at the time, right? So very interesting to watch this project. In the same way that Spring Boot has rejuvenated itself and gotten better with time, so too has Axon, which is I think a very compelling thing. If you're a customer and you want to know about a project, it says a lot that there are people that are still using it after 10 years. There are people that are willing to double down and buy into the technology through the to work with the Axonic itself, the company, as opposed to just the open source framework. And that the project is still not just growing, but growing by leaps and bounds, you know?
Yeah, and you can see that from the videos from the Axonic conference that happens in September, I think, normally each year. Those companies are there speaking about their experience of using Axon framework for their workloads, and invariably they're talking about large scale deployments that handle many millions of transactions sometimes daily, which is an astonishing number, and they seem to really like it, and I think it for anyone who's interested in finding out more about CKRS and event sourcing, and if they're comfortable with Java, then it's a fantastic place to start. That's where I started, and that's where I think people should start as well. I think it's got a lot of guardrails and a lot of really sensible, well thought out APIs and decisions in that particular framework that really help to smooth out that learning curve.
I think that's a great point there. One of the nice things about this was that I understood at least I thought I understood the CQRS pattern, but when it came time to translate that into code, I was a little bit at a loss because what could have been the Ruby on Rails for CQRS? I wanted something that just said, here, fill out this, do this, this, and this, and this, and then ta-da, you have an application that satisfies the definition of this pattern, right? And with MVC, you use Spring MVC, and you know what to do when. You know that if you create a controller, that'll be a controller in the MVC sense. You know that if you create so you learn what parts comprise the whole thing, and you see how they figure together. And then Bob's your uncle. You've got a working web application. Well, the same was we didn't have the same thing for CQRS. So to have a component model built on top of Spring that integrates with Spring that supports the sort of logical pieces of this pattern, and that gives you this very clear-cut sort of like approach. You just do this, this, and this, and this, and assuming you haven't done something catastrophically bad, you'll have a working app. That's incredible.
Very nice things, you guys. Thanks a lot for that.
Well, thank you. So what can we expect? We've got a little bit of time here. We're going to wind down here, I'm afraid. But what can we expect going forward? What is the next big thing? What's Axon 10, or at least Axon 5 or 4? What are we at now? 3? Still 3? 5?
No, we're on the verge of releasing 4.1.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So
what's the big thing to do in there?
So 4.1 is... a lot of minor fixes and small things we did. We released 4.0 last year on a conference, So in September we announced we'd do it, and in October we released it. That was quite a big rework because we initially had two products which we consolidated into Axon Server. 4.1, like I said, a lot of stability things we really wanted to get going, and minor things we left when we first made the leap from 3 to 4.
That's awesome. All right. So it looks like you're barreling ahead, full steam ahead. And that's nice because, again, it took a, you know, for those just listening, it took, you know, most of a decade to get to 3 releases. And the fact that we've, you know, a year after that or so, maybe it's 2 years, but the fact that it's a very short period of time, we're already at 4.1, you know, that's you can see there's a increased velocity, which is great.
Yes. No, that was definitely quite a step. The years between 1 and 2 and 2 and 3 are far longer than between 3 and 4. But we saw the necessity and the growing need of it all, and we just needed to restructure the whole thing to make it more sensible, to make it compelling to the specific things we find important.
Yeah. And it was much, much easier to configure between 3 to 4 with Spring Boot as well. There was a huge, huge improvement there, I feel.
Nice. Oh, see, that's good. I started the work with Alard a few years ago for the Spring Boot auto config, and he ran away with it. He just absolutely, I remember him having all these interesting ideas, and it's good to see the best thing about Spring Boot is that it reduces the surface area of the configuration. So you can't break, there's less to break between changes because less of it is something that the user has to think about, right?
Absolutely. Yes,
So that's a good thing too. So hopefully now we get more flexibility while retaining better backwards compatibility with it, which is a good problem to have, good place to be, you know. Well, I appreciate your time, gents. It's been amazing. I think we learned a lot. I certainly learned a lot. I look forward to trying out the bits and to engaging with you further. Where can our listeners find both of you, Stephen and Ben, on the internet, on the inner tubes?
Well, you'll find me mostly on Twitter, so at BenBravo73, I think, is me. Stephen, what's your handle?
Yeah, so I'm also on Twitter, and my handle is at SMCVBeelen. So that's my surname tied to it.
B-E-E.
L-E-N. Yes. L-E-N.
Okay. Awesome. Correct. And then is there anything else you want to leave our listeners with? Is there something we didn't get to, something I could have done a better job covering?
I'd very much like to hear people who would approach us saying, hey, I heard this podcast from Josh, this awesome podcast, and now we came to this thing, the Axon Trader and the Axon, what you're doing, and I just want to learn more. That would be so cool.
Where should they go? Is there a resource portal or something like that? What's the website to go to?
Axonic.io.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Are you Dutch, Stephen?
Yes, I'm Dutch. Yes.
Thank you, Val. Thank you, Val. Something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Thanks.
All right, gents. Have a great day. Thanks so much. And for those of you listening, we'll see you next time. A Beautiful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs's Them from Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs's Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.